I'm making this podcast episode on the morning of Monday, January 26th, as we do every day at 9 a.m. East Coast time. The Open Heart Project Sangha, my online meditation community, gathers together to practice meditation for 20, 30 minutes and then have a discussion as needed. It's wonderful. It happens 7 days a week. And this morning, I was one of the co-teachers that I was teaching with my great friend, Michael Carroll. There's normally about 50 to 65 people in our morning meditations, which is a lot. It's amazing to see. This morning, there were 90. And I don't think it's any mystery why. This is a terrible, terrible day in the history of the United States of America. And many of us, myself included, need to be together with like-minded people, to see each other's faces, and to ponder together, what the hell, and what can we do? So the first thing I said in our session this morning was, let me just start out by saying, I know this is a terrible time, terrifying and enraging, and there is nothing I can say to make it better. Let's just put that right out there. There's no Buddhist teachings that can recontextualize the horror that we're seeing in the United States of America, particularly in Minneapolis, as something reasonable or okay. So let's just take those things off the table. And what is left is to see and feel the suffering that is happening. Really feel and see. My fellow teacher, Michael Carroll, said that he had always felt since he was a boy that this country, the United States of America, has always operated with an extraordinary amount of hypocrisy. And I could see why he said that. And his preference, he said, was when it comes to things like hypocrisy and cruelty, is let's see them. It's better when they're exposed, and it's worse when they're hidden. So now it's exposed. We stand the possibility of changing things because it is. Okay, good point, Michael Carroll. Then we sat, and during our meditation, I was thinking, so I get an F for this particular meditation, that while I agree wholeheartedly with what he was saying, I also agree with myself that that is not the whole story. I was raised by first-generation Americans who instilled in me repeatedly during my childhood that this was a great country, that what they were able to accomplish, they could not have approximated in any way in the countries where their parents were born. So they were grateful. Now, that's not the case for every child of immigrants, so I'm not trying to say anything like that. However, for them, they had opportunities. They made lives that they could feel proud of. They were able to give their children what they did not have growing up, and that is true for many immigrant families, and not true for many as well. So I'm not trying to suggest otherwise. And it wasn't all, you know, kittens and balloons for them. My father especially was born into a home of, I don't want to say it was poor, but hard scrabble. Let's use that word. He fought in World War II for this country. The only moment I've ever felt, well, it's probably best that he's passed away, is this moment, so he does not have to see what is happening in the country he fought for. He went to medical school on the Jewish quota. So there were only so many Jews that were allowed to become physicians back in that day, and that was not that long ago. It was my father. That was one guy ago. So things worked out well for him. And again, I'm not saying that they do for others, but they did for him. And he was grateful, and so was my mother. And they weren't like, oh, this is the best country, never criticize it. But they were appreciative. So let's not forget that that is also who we are. We are also a country who opened its arms to immigrants, who supported countless people to make better lives, not for themselves, but for their children. And for whatever fucked up reasons, has decided to take that back in recent years. But that doesn't erase what happened in history. Let's also not forget that this country produced Martin Luther King Jr., that we elected a black man president twice, that until probably the last 10 or 15 or even 20 years, we've always been leaders in the fields of science and psychology. We're not only founded on hypocrisy. It's important not to forget that. Now, normally, when it comes to profoundly challenging situations such as the one we're in now in the United States of America and elsewhere, we must respond. But the danger is in choosing one of what are called the three poisons as our response. The first poison is called grasping, which is some sense of freaking out, like, oh my God, how do we make this stop? This has to stop. I don't want this to be happening. Help me. Let me tell you about all the terrible things that are going on. Because if I can unload to you, my load will be less. So yes, it's important to talk about the tragic cruelty that is afoot. It's important not to look away, although sometimes you have to give yourself a break. It's important to talk about what is wrong. But when I or someone tells you all of the horrific thoughts I've been having and fears that I have, because I don't want to feel this as intensely as I do, so let me just cut a piece of the pie for you and hand it to you. Now you have to hold my suffering. This makes me feel a little bit better. Well, that is a big mistake. That's a disservice and an unkindness when you share your thoughts because you want someone else to hold the pain for you. So it's important to be aware of that. The second poison is called delusion, which is some version of anything along these lines. I'm just not going to look. And, you know, we all have to take breaks. So I'm not saying that you should rub your face in the horrors. But my life's okay. I'm going to stay in my house. I'm not going to look. That's delusion. You're just ignoring the reality of what's happening in your world. Another form of delusion is looking directly at a video, for example, of someone being murdered and saying that didn't happen. Because I can't afford to acknowledge that it did. Or pretending that you have some sense of, well, that person was actually a domestic terrorist or whatever bullshit one might come up with. Those are ways of hiding from the pain. And that's what we want to avoid. The third poison, and the most dangerous, I would say, is called aggression, which you look at things that you don't like, things that are wrong, and you want to destroy them. You want to fight them. You want to take them down. You want to push them out of reality. Okay. Destroying, fighting, yelling, pushing things out of reality, those are good things to do. Those things must happen. However, when we attempt to do those things with aggression, they will fall flat. Now, I'm not a historian, not an academic, so forth and so on. But in my observation, there is no instance in recorded history where aggression has defeated aggression. Aggression leads to more aggression. So we have to fight. We have to speak. We have to speak very loudly. We have to change the course that our country is on without aggression. How do you do that? Well, now you're above my pay grade, so I don't know. But I believe it begins with contemplating. That, can I mean you, ask yourself, can I fight aggression without aggression? What would that look like? What would that feel like? can I see examples of that in my world? If you look, you will find examples. So now what? I have two very unsatisfying suggestions that are based in my practice of more than 30 years as a Buddhist practitioner and a meditator and a meditation teacher and so forth and so on. And the first thing that gives me a sense of strength when I feel completely depleted is the following. I talked about this in a podcast some months ago. I'm going to talk about it again. In Buddhist cosmology, it is thought that there are six realms of existence. According to this view, in your previous lives, in your future lives, you have passed through or will pass through all of them. We'll just talk about the first three because they're the relevant ones right now. The first realm, and you can say these are real places, as many people do, or these are psychological states, as many more people do. Whatever, they seem real. The first realm of existence is called the God realm. And it sounds good, and in a lot of ways it is. These are beings, not you and me, but these are beings who have everything they want. They think of something that they wish was there, and it's there. They have something they don't want anymore, it's gone. They're always young. They're always beautiful. They're psychic. They can fly. They live a really, really long time, which sounds all good, and presumably it is. And we parenthetically have witnessed people in our culture who seem like they're in the God realm. Everything they want comes to them. They're beautiful. They may not be able to fly, but they can transport themselves to wherever they want to go. And things seem to go really, really well for them. You may have had such moments in your life, whether it's a day or a week or a year. So that's the feeling of the God realm. Everything goes your way. Okay? What could be wrong? You might be wondering. Well, you do die at some point, and the death is said to be very long and very painful. And the Buddha can't help. The Buddha appears in each of the six realms, according to this cosmology, in different forms. And in the God realm, he appears as a musician who's just standing there playing music. Because, I mean, it sounds nice. I'm sure it is. I'm sure it's good. But there's nothing to say. When everything is going your way, there's no reason to study the Dharma. Why? So you're going to die and you're going to have to come back to this cycle of birth, old age, sickness, and death. Okay. We're not there. We're not in the God realm. So something to think about. The next realm is called the jealous God realm. And they're jealous that they're not gods. They want to be in that realm. And they think that the way to get there is through warfare, like serious warfare, unending attacks. Everything that happens in their life, big or small, is a battle that is either won or lost. And losing creates a greater sense of warfare, and winning creates a greater sense of warfare because there's never enough. The jealous gods never have enough. They want what the other jealous gods have, and they want what the gods have, and they will fight and lie to the death to get it. Now, I believe we're seeing that in our world today. We're seeing a battle of jealous gods. That's one way to look at it. We're also seeing a lot of horrifying bullshit. So I'm not trying to make it sound like it's a nice spiritual thing. It isn't. They're also never going to study the Dharma because they're too busy fighting. They don't have time. So they're going to die too and have to repeat the cycle. And the Buddha, I'm not sure what the Buddha in the jealous God realm was doing, probably just watching in horror like the rest of us. But there's no point in teaching because there's no one that's going to listen. The third realm is called the human realm. That's our realm. That's where we are. This is the good one, y'all, because we have the right ratio of ease to suffering. Like, presumably, if you're listening to this, you have something to listen to it on. You're inside. you could eat food, you have a place to live or friends. So you have the things that one would need to create some bandwidth for studying the Dharma. When you're in fight or flight, which we have all been, or most of us have been at some point in our lives, there's no point in studying the Dharma. You can't, because you're fighting for survival. But you and I have enough means at our disposal to not feel in a constant fight for survival. Now, that could change in any moment. But we also have suffering. We have loss. We have disappointment. We have illness. We have all the things that I don't have to list for you, even though I just did. And those are the things that make us want to study the Dharma, to wake up, to pursue a spiritual path that we then have enough space to do, even if it's only a little bit of space. We have enough suffering and ease to pursue the Dharma. And in our realm, the human realm, the Buddha appeared as a being, as a teacher, Shakyamuni Buddha. So the other realms, which I won't go into, are the hungry ghost realm, populated by beings who are starving and can never get enough. The animal realm, which is, we know what that is, animals. We love them. They're all in a survival mode constantly. And then the final realm is called the hell realm. And in Buddhist cosmology, there are many hells, cold hells, hot hells, all the hells, as hellish as you would imagine. But for purpose of our conversation, I want to say that when I think about defeating my enemies, my immediate realization is I can't defeat them. I don't have their weapons. And I don't just mean artillery. I don't have their mindset. I don't have their whatever effed up thing is going on inside of them. I don't have that. In moments, maybe I do, but I can't fight them because I'm not in their world. I cannot defeat them right now. The time will come when I can, but not right now, it would appear. So what do I do in the meantime? When I cannot defeat my enemies, I can strengthen my friends. I can contribute to the human realm where we live. And our weapons are not vile greed and hatred. Our weapons are legislation, philosophies, verbal skills, psychological strategies. Those things are good, but they do not play in the jealous God realm. They fall flat. So in the meantime, when I'm not going to be able to get in there and defeat, although I can fight, and we must fight, I can do what I can to strengthen my friends, which is you, which is the human realm. Because our time will come. And we want to be strong when it does. And when we focus on what we can't do, on what we can't defeat, and fall into despair, which who hasn't done that 10 times today? We get weaker and weaker. We have to preserve our strength. And I find myself feeling very disempowered, I'll just say again, when I think about how am I going to defeat the enemies? Feel without power. And right now, again, I believe I am. But when I think about what can I do to strengthen my friends, I feel a resurgence of my personal power. I can do that. I can do what I can to help. And you can do what you can to help. And whatever that is, you should do it. It's going to be your way. Thank you. It's also important, I feel, to keep imagining the better world, to not fall into cynicism and self-shaming, like, don't be in la-la land, look at the reality. Yeah, don't be in la-la land, look at the reality, but keep dreaming. We must dream on behalf of ourselves and others, because there are many people right now who cannot dream because someone's in their house trying to kill them, or they're starving, or they're freezing, whatever it may be, they cannot dream. And because they cannot dream, they cannot see what is possible. And because they cannot see what is possible for very good reason, they cannot work toward that possibility. When we lose the ability to envision, we lose the ability to accomplish. So please keep seeing, not spiritual bypassingly, keep seeing, not by spiritually bypassing, I know I've said that a dozen times, not by pretending, but by knowing that within human beings exists tremendous goodness, and we can, even though it may seem impossible to imagine right now, we can make a world that is sane. The more far-fetched that seems, the more important it is to return to the vision. Return to the vision. Because what we can dream, we can do. And what we lose the ability to dream, we cannot do. So please, find a way to keep seeing what is possible. Don't let it be stomped on and murdered by despair. So I'll close here with an example from my own life of despair and possibility. So this is some time ago, actually, it was 2016. I'll never forget it. I went to Auschwitz, the concentration camp, with my family, because someone thought that would be a good idea. And honestly, I kind of wish I never went, because it's impossible to live or draw a single breath after an experience like that without remembering it. Nonetheless, I went, and it's weird. You get a tour. There's a tour guide in our group. I don't remember how many were there, but he was wonderful. And as we went from scene of horror to scene of horror, which I will not describe to you right now, because that would be unkind, I didn't know what to think. I didn't know what to do. I mean, sob, yes. Feel, yes. Hate, maybe. Fear. Yeah, all those things seem to be reasonable responses. But anytime I tried to make a theory about this, well, it's because of the economic situation, or it's because people hate Jews, or it's because this megalomaniac got people's attention. And I don't know, all the things that one might posit about a Holocaust, none of that mattered. They all seemed like different pools of quicksand. And what I found myself doing was chanting to myself, not out loud, the sadhana that was my main practice at that time, the practice that I did daily during that time, which I loved. I did for many years, and I would still do it at any time, but I have a different practice now, whatever. That's not the point. I'd done the practice so many times I could recite it by heart. So I found that as I was walking through these various scenes of horror beyond description, that my mind stream was saying this sadhana. It was saying the lines. And I was like, why am I doing that? I'm not sure. But it didn't feel like, oh, I'm trying to make myself feel better. I'm trying to cling to something. The best explanation I have is that I was trying to mix something profound and sane and heartfelt with something insane and cruel and stupid. I was trying to mix into that atmosphere something else. And I could have done it, I suppose, by arguing and counter-arguing, and I don't know what, but all I could do, and this is my suggestion, should you find it useful, is when you find yourself in situations beyond horrific, things you never imagined could happen, or even just normal horrific, that you find something within yourself that you can mix into it. some teaching that has spoken to you, an image or a feeling about a person who exemplifies something good and upstanding and real. Bring that in through your heart, your mind, however you want to think of it, and let the feeling of that thing that is also true mix with the environment of what is insane. So we can send out little tendrils of sanity. I'm not saying that that's going to solve the world's problems, but who knows? So I guess I'll stop there. The next podcast episode, by the way, I want to talk about the Noble Eightfold Path, which is right view, right intention, right speech, and so on, because I find that these are practical, helpful, and profound teachings on how to navigate everyday life from a place of sanity. They're not philosophies, they're not strategies, they're not theories. They're ways to be. So please come back. Thank you.